What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. If you are new here, Polititeen is a podcast that hopes to spark political conversation in our youth by talking about current politics with people that are currently politically active. With that being said, thank you for tuning in to today's episode, and as always, happy listening. What is going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Varun.
Hey guys, my name is Varun Kanathala. I am the co-host of the Polititeen podcast. We at Polititeen try to spark political conversation in every one of our discussions, you know, inspire young minds to go out in the elections, the polls in November, and to make their voices heard, as many of our guests talk about on the podcast. And speaking of guests today, we have a very special guest. Damian, it's Dr. Greiner, and Dr. Greiner, he is a, you know, a big advocate for kind of the connection between business and politics. He talked with us about this earlier before the podcast, but if you'd like to introduce yourself, Doctor, we would love to have our viewers hear about you.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you, Damian and Varun. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here. I am actually the father of two young people, a little bit older than teenagers now, and of course, as a college professor, I teach lots of folks who are recently teenagers. So I'm happy to be here and really happy to be a part of this. Basically, what my background is I right out of college. In fact, even during college, I got involved in politics, in Democratic politics, and worked on various political campaigns all over the country. Worked for a couple presidential campaigns, even managed some congressional campaigns, and ended up here in Michigan, where I met my wife. So that kept me here. Right. Since then, I went to law school, practiced law for a while, then went back and got my PhD in business management. Lately, I've been just working on doing research on the relationship between business and government, and also doing some writing on politics and basically teaching students, which I love to do.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. Well, my first question for you would be, how did you really get down this career path where you know, both in teaching students and really, I'm assuming that you do it more so in your free time, kind of write these articles. Was there a moment that you really decided that you wanted to engage in politics? Was it something that, you know, maybe happened when you were younger, an election or something that you can recall?
Oh, definitely. In fact, I'll tell you something. I've always been interested in politics. Even as a kid, I remember talking with my father about it. You know, really what happened is, and this is a typical story for anybody who's been involved in politics, is one day when I was in college, I went down to a local political campaign and volunteered to do some door-to-door and stuff some envelopes. And that's how you get started in politics. And the truth of the matter is, being involved in politics at any level is exciting. And that's one thing I remember James Carville talking about this, where some young people were asking him, you know, how do you get involved in running a presidential campaign? And he said, look, you know, get involved in your local mayoral campaign or a local state representative campaign, because the truth of the matter is those campaigns are as exciting as winning a presidential campaign when you win. And you learn as much. In some cases, you learn even more. And I can tell you one thing, having actually worked in municipal government, one thing that's amazing about local and state government is so much attention gets focused on the federal government, but the reality is our day-to-day lives are much more affected by local government and state government.
Yeah.
Local government deals with things like schools and roads and electricity and water and things like that really we deal with on a daily basis. State government deals with things like unemployment insurance and healthcare and police. All these things that really impact us on a daily basis. Most people, most of the time, really don't interact with the federal government very much at all.
Yeah, and that's very true. I mean, especially in today's landscape, you know, you were a former deputy mayor of Warren, Michigan, so you know your fair share about being involved in local government. Obviously, you know, I've seen kids and even in people I've talked to just not think about the importance of even local politics, local policy, local public government. But I think the main issue right now, we're talking to candidates, we've been interviewing candidates from across local government. We really haven't gone on to the congressional government on a nationwide level, but it's been mostly local candidates. And I was talking to Damian about this before I jumped on the podcast. I applied for an internship from one of our former guests, you know, Sam Park, who was representative for House District 101 in Georgia. And so that kind of introduced me to kind of the background of how to apply for that position. And you bring up a very valid point. Now I wanted to mention something about on more of a local level than not. You obviously have very strong perspectives about public policy, social issues, because I've read your articles on Medium and I've loved them and read them. In local politics, I think that one of the biggest issues that I've been facing is the fact that in Georgia, schools have been faced with a very, very different decision. And that's been, you know, whether to have schools virtual or schools in person. Now, there's a very different perspectives among Democratic and Republican people about this kind of policy. So I wanted to gauge, I guess, what is your stance towards schools reopening? You know, should we have schools reopening to a full capacity or have it held back, part-time school, hybrid school, or even virtual school? What do you think and why do you think so?
Okay, well, let me start by saying that it's tragic that questions like this and whether to wear a mask in public and whether to go out and associate with people have become political acts. Right. Frankly, those are largely as a result of a lot of the rhetoric that we're seeing come out of the White House. And this shouldn't be something political. In most countries, it's not. And the truth of the matter is most countries right now are looking at the United States and are absolutely stunned by what's going on here. In other countries, they are able to address these decisions in a rational way, where they talk about the science and look at what's the best way to address it. And frankly, as a result of it, most countries have handled this crisis much, much better than the United States has. So that's the first thing. The second thing that I think is important to acknowledge is the fact that this didn't have to be as bad as it is right now. That there were any number of steps that could have been taken early on to try to address this. And perhaps the worst decision that was made of all was the idea to rush back into economic activity before we were really ready to. It's not like there weren't people out there warning us about it. You know, Dr. Fauci is only the most prominent person who is warning us about it. But there are lots of scientists at all different levels who are saying, we're not ready for this. We need to make sure we have proper levels of testing. We need to make sure that we have meet certain benchmarks before we go forward. And unfortunately, there was this decision made, again, really politically driven, that we need to get, that we want to get the economy going, basically to help the Republicans with their reelection effort, rather than waiting until things are under control. It's really come back and bitten us in the butt as a result of that. Now we're dealing with a crisis much worse than most countries are dealing with. Really, we're still not dealing with it at the level we should be. Now, in terms of the schools, you know, this is really, in truth, a very, very difficult decision. And this is the reality about most decisions in government and politics, which is that we like to simplify these things down to some kind of rhetorical sentence that makes it seem like it's easy, but it's not. These are complex decisions that require the balancing of many different perspectives. And so, for example, with this, on the one hand, it's clear kids learn better when they're in school, especially as they're younger. But even at the college level, I can tell you that in general, students who are in a classroom learn better when they're in the classroom than online. And I've taught both online classes and in the classroom classes, so I can say that with some experience. But especially as they get younger, I mean, I have a grandson who's 5 years old, and he's scheduled to start kindergarten in the fall. And I can tell you, if he doesn't go to kindergarten, he's really going to be missing out on something, because there's this narrow window where children can get the benefit of this early education, and not being able to be in a classroom is really going to be something that's a burden for him. So that's the one side. The second side is this economic issue with the shutdowns is not anything to be laughed at. This is a serious issue. There are lots of small businesses that are going out of business now for the sole reason that they can't do business. Having been a small business person myself, I can tell you that if I were told I can't operate my business and make any money for a certain period of time, there's only a relatively short window that I could stay in business before I'd be put out of business. And we're seeing that. I think the latest figures I saw are over 100,000 businesses are not going to reopen as a result of this crisis. So this is not some small crisis here. So I certainly understand the perspective of the people saying we've got to reopen the economy as quickly as possible. By the same token, then, this is a legitimate risk here. You know, we focus on the number of cases that have occurred. And obviously, that's gone up dramatically in Florida and in Texas and in Arizona and a number of states. And nationwide, it's starting to as well now. That's a real concern. And now the death rate is starting to go up in those states as well, which shows that even though it's a lagging indicator that this is a legitimate issue. But I think something that also hasn't been talked about enough is the fact that even if people survive this sickness, there can be serious after effects that they deal with. You know, it can affect people's, right. people's heart, their lungs, their brain function. So this is not a laughing matter at all. When government is done responsibly, it tries to balance these different perspectives and figure out how are we going to come to some kind of resolution that will achieve the goals of all of them. And to me, the answer, frankly, is quite straightforward. What we should have done and what we still could do is really engage in a serious shutdown, really focus on building up the testing, make sure that we have the protections in place, that then when we reopen, we're able to reopen without people being at risk again. And that's really the missed opportunity that we have right now. And unfortunately, I think in terms of the schools, it probably needs to be a case-by-case basis, because I can tell you that there are certain areas where the virus is really out of control now, certain areas right. where it's in better control and where they have better measures to protect people. I can tell you, Michigan, we're actually in pretty good shape compared to some other states. And that's largely because of the fact that the governor was a hard ass about it. You know, she did not fool around, and she was actually attacked by the president and other Republicans as a result of it. But the result is that Michigan is in better shape than a lot of other states right now. And so my hope is that they'll be able to reopen the schools. But again, that question should be driven by the science. It shouldn't be driven by political considerations.
I'm gonna interject here and just say that, you know, we're from Georgia, one of the most Republican states in the South, and one of the most lenient states with the coronavirus, the first state to reopen. Yeah. And, you know, being from there, it just shows that a small sacrifice, you know, a little shutdown in the beginning can really save lives. Oh, yeah. And that sacrifice is incredible because, I mean, Damien, I'm kind of taking up a little bit of your time over here. But
don't worry about it.
So in Florida, I heard that the governor was like, it's okay to sacrifice old people's lives for the economy.
Yeah.
And that's a moral kind of line that you're crossing. And it's a line he has crossed. The Governor Kemp has crossed, I think, in our governor in Georgia by I think yesterday or the day before, he said that it's illegal for any entity to mandate masks in Georgia. Yeah. And Keisha Lance Bottoms came out and she said, or the mayor of Atlanta, she's like, I'm not going to follow that. You know, I'm not going to follow that. And I'm going to pull up a quote as we're speaking right now. But I believe here, Damien, you can go ahead. I'm going to pull up a quote that she said not reopening.
Well, piggyback riding. What's the term here? Going back on what piggybacking on what you're saying there. it's very interesting because, you know, in my perspective, the Republican lawmakers and Republican representatives and stuff have always considered themselves the defender of the Constitution. And this is a very interesting perspective off of, you know, Bo, that a guest that we might have on the podcast, hopefully very, very soon. And I was watching him say this, and he said they've always been considered the defenders of the Constitution, but yet the Constitution opens with we the people of the United States in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, and this is the important part here, provide for the common defense, and promote the general welfare. It's very interesting that the same people that are considering themselves the defender of the Constitution don't read beyond the we the people. They just say we the people. And you know, they take all of this into their own interpretations when really they've always said that they defend the Constitution in its whole and its entirety. But to promote the general welfare and provide for the common defense, wouldn't that be wearing a mask? Wouldn't you know, defending your citizens be wearing a mask? And it's just an odd situation. Do you think that there's a constitutional issue with wearing masks?
Oh, no, absolutely not. And you know, the Supreme Court actually has has laid down guidelines about this, you know, in terms of when government has a right to step in and when government doesn't have a right to step in. And the reality is they talk about there be balancing acts where government needs to consider the burden that their actions are going to place upon individual rights versus the greater good that's going to come from it. And we see examples of this everywhere, like, for example, with local governments being able to engage in zoning. Does that something that steps on individuals' property rights? Yes, it does. You know, but yet there can be circumstances where there is something with the greater health and safety and welfare of the community that's determined by where certain kinds of businesses are going to be located relative to others. And everybody thinks that's okay. We all accept that. That's, again, though, where it comes down to what I was talking about earlier, which is that this whole issue of masks has become so politicized. There's no constitutional rights to not wear a mask. That's absurd. And for a government to say, you know, hey, you need to wear a mask to basically protect other people and yourself from a serious virus, that just makes sense. So there's kind of become this political discussion. But I want to kind of echo something that you were saying, though, Damien, which is, it's like what Republicans have done is that they've weaponized certain rhetoric. Where what they've done is that they've said, you know, oh, the Constitution says this, knowing that most people haven't sat down and actually read the Constitution.
Yeah.
You know, or most people don't actually understand the body of law that has grown out of the Constitution. You know, in my class that I teach, you know, I teach a business law class to college students, and it's a required class of all business students. Most of my students are juniors and seniors in college, and I really have to spend a lot of time talking with them about kind of some of the basic ideas behind how our government works, because there seems to be just a lack of information out there for many people, and it gets filled with this rhetoric that's very emotionally charged, and they try to base it on these ideas of, you know, oh, we're out to protect justice, or oh, we're out to protect the Constitution. And one of the things that I think has really, and this is going to sound really strange, but almost been really revealing about the current administration, is it's shown so many of these things that have been claimed by the Republicans for so long to be what they are, which are empty claims.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the podcast is here, Dr. Grinder, because we want to start conversation and educate our peers. Because as you said, a lot of teens don't really have an educated political opinion. They kind of shadow in their parents' feelings, and they shadow in their peers' feelings. It's not developed for themselves. So I think that, you know, a message for all of our teens that are watching our podcast, Young Minds, don't become engrossed in this kind of political propaganda. Do your own research, you know. Yeah. And it's hard. You know, it's hard because every single one of our news channels, our major news channels, are tainted with some kind of opinion. And that's why I go to Medium. You know, Medium is where I find my news. And I was looking at your article. Obviously, you're a Democrat. But I think that reading articles from regular people brings in different perspectives, because these media entities are so politicized. I feel like, you know, reading your articles, I've read them, a couple of your articles, especially I resonated with the one about how Republicans are kind of jumping from a sinking ship. And me and Damien have talked about that time and time again on the podcast. And it's the fact that, you know, we're having David Perdue not mention Trump in his advertisements, because it's not going to get Trump, or it's not going to get him past the primary elections. You know, people don't support Trump as much as they did before. And it's riveting. So I think right now it's political, but is there kind of, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this question to you, but in my personal perspective, this should have been done a long time ago, right? Yeah. Because Republicans should have had that moral decision. It shouldn't have been prompted by political issues. What do you think? What do you think is really prompting this, other than the political reasons? You know, them being winning the election. You know, are they actually taking these out of their own moral standpoint, or is it just political, purely political?
No, I think I think that that's really actually the point with that column that I wrote, which is that there's this distinction between people who have taken a moral stand and who have been raising issues for some time about this, and those people deserve some credit. You know, I have disagreed most of my life with things that George Conway has said, or that any number of these other Republicans out there who make up the Republicans Against Trump and the Lincoln Project, for example. But yet they are standing up and saying this is not something that's acceptable. And I have to respect their integrity for being willing to do that, because, you know, unfortunately, that's just in such short supply nowadays. And I think, and this is the kind of the untold story about all this, which is most Republican politicians, they're not stupid. They know that this administration is a joke, and that this president is incompetent, and that he's caused all kinds of problems for them and probably hurt the party's prospects for the long term. But they are afraid to say it out in public because of the fact that he then attacks them, and he's got enough support within the Republican Party that he can cause them serious problems if they stand up to him at all. I mean, we just had a great example of that in the recent Alabama primary, where Jeff Sessions lost the primary. There's a guy, he was Trump's number one supporter in the Senate. Literally, he was the first person to endorse Trump who was a member of the U.S. Senate. He was Trump's first attorney general. And solely because of the fact that he said that there should be some distance between a member of the administration and the investigation into the links between the Trump campaign and Russia, solely because he said that and he didn't want to politicize that investigation, he was put out to the curb and now has lost his primary. Now, again, I'm no fan of Jeff Sessions. Believe me, I'm not. But the fact is, at least he was willing to take a principled stance there, which you have to respect the guy for that, especially in this day and age where we see so little of that going on.
Yeah, no, and speaking about kind of Trump attacking people, I wanted to ask you your personal take on him demoting Brad Parcell. I've never known how to pronounce his name, but a lot of people have said that the reason that he's only demoting him and not firing him is because if he fires him, then he's out of fear. And I don't know if this is in relation to the Lincoln Project, you know, their whole Whispers campaign. For viewers that don't know, they put out a campaign that basically, or an ad that basically was saying, speaking directly to Trump, and saying, you know, everyone's out to get you and your administration and you know, no one likes you and stuff. And so do you think that the idea of him only demoting Brad was because of the fact that he fears that he'll come out in retaliation and say things about, you know, the campaign?
Yeah, I definitely think that's the case. And you're right about that ad, by the way. That's a very powerful ad. But I remember watching it the first time and thinking to myself, that's not really an ad aimed at voters. That's an ad aimed at Trump, because it's not going to convince anybody not to support him or to, you know, or to support somebody else. What it's going to do is it's going to create all kinds of paranoia within Trump's mind.
And it did.
And for sure. And I think you're right. I mean, but also part of what's not talked about a lot is the fact that he's really not a very good manager. You know, there's this image created of him as this tough-minded manager that was really created as a narrative from the show The Apprentice. You know, where he'd sit there and say, "You're fired." When in reality, we look at what happened, he's afraid to tell anybody they're fired. The way that Brad, you're right, I don't know how to pronounce his last name either, but the way that he found out about his demotion was through Twitter. So the fact that this guy isn't willing to pick up the phone and tell his top campaign aide, "Hey, you know, I'm making a change here," just speaks to his weakness. Now, I got to tell you again, as a small business person, as a government manager, etc., I've had to fire people. I've had to demote people. Not a lot of fun, for sure. You know, but you know, you—that's part of the job. Is you pull on your big boy pants or big girl pants or whatever, and you go and you talk to the person. The fact that this guy has so frequently fired people via tweet or demoted them via tweet, or where they don't even know what's going on, just really speaks to his own weakness as a manager. And I think that's something that we're constantly dealing with in this administration, is kind of this competition between incompetence and ineffectiveness versus downright self-service and corruption.
I mean, yeah, you bring up a very good point, but you know, it's not even something that's like just now. I mean, we've seen him leave the WHO without telling half his administration, our ambassador to European entities, many of them actually, they came out and they're like, "I had no goddamn idea." Like, I mean, he just spoke about it and I found out about it via Twitter, CNN. And there needs to be some kind of transparency, because not only between the administration and the people who work for us, work for the nation, but also other countries. You know, our country was getting phone calls from Britain, India, almost every single nation from across the world, because we were the biggest donor. You know, we kind of made the WHO, and us leaving without telling anybody, consulting anybody's opinion, it not only reflects bad on Trump, I think it reflects bad on our nation.
For sure.
You know, speaking about, you know, reflecting bad and bad things kind of coming out of Trump's conscience, I want to discuss what you think, and this is an interesting topic that I want to talk about. It is, you know, the rationale behind why people support Donald Trump, because I was reading an article on Medium again. I'm talking about how African Americans support Trump and why they do it. But, you know, I guess, why do you think people support Trump and still continue to support Trump? Because from personal experience, I've seen that it's extremely, extremely hard to convince somebody that Trump is not the right candidate. And it's one of the hardest things I've ever seen in politics. So why is it that people are so rigid on their standpoints?
Well, there's this theory in psychology called cognitive dissonance.
Right.
And basically what that says is that we have certain beliefs that we've adopted. The more that we invest into that belief, then what we'll actually do is we will ignore evidence that's to the contrary of that belief. And that's a lot of what you see going on with the Trump supporters, is that literally they don't want to hear anything that's going to somehow convince them that he's not, you know, the second coming. Literally, so they will discount information that will somehow conflict with it. And you hear it all the time, you know, where they talk about fake news or that's lies or whatever. It's a way of discounting information that's going to disagree with it. And but fundamentally, and I think we have to call a spade here. You know what Trump is playing on is he's playing on racism. You know, that's what originally brought him to the running for president, you know, when he was really leading the whole birther conspiracy against President Obama. You know, he was his first speech when he started running. Remember talking about the Mexican rapists and that type of thing?
Yeah.
You know, throughout his campaign, I mean, this is a guy who he's gone beyond the idea of dog whistles, you know, just kind of implying that you're talking about race. And he just openly makes racist comments. I mean, who can forget the very fine people on both sides in that Charlottesville riot?
Yeah.
It's really disturbing to see the way that he's reacted to the Black Lives Matter. I think that what you see going on here is you see a long-term change going on in our country. And this comes down to something that, you know, I think Varun raised, which is, you know, young people are driving this in a lot of ways. You know, when you look at the difference in attitudes between people older than me through my generation, you know, and I'm really a Gen Xer, I guess you could call me, you know, down to the kind of the millennials and younger, there is this incredible change that occurs as people get younger and they're more, even if you don't want to call them more liberal, they're more open-minded, they're more
progressive. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't see race the way that that older people do. I mean, it's really amazing. I'll tell you a story here real fast, kind of as an illustration. This is about my grandson. He's 5. And it just shows how much things have changed, where now he literally does not see race. You know, where when he sees, say there is an African-American person and a white person on television, he'll describe the African-American person as the person wearing the red shirt. You know, and younger people more and more, that it just isn't a factor in their minds. And, you know, for young people, you can't even imagine. You know, I remember the days when it was okay to use the N-word in public society. You know, when it was about gay people and the changes that we've seen in society in attitudes toward gay people. That's just been remarkable. I'll tell you, I would not have predicted 20 years ago that we would have gay marriage as the law of the land and essentially sexual orientation being a basis to file a job discrimination claim. I never would have imagined that just 20 years ago. So things are changing very quickly, and it's largely because of the change in attitudes from young people. So as young people are getting older, and you folks are kind of becoming a larger and larger part of the voting population, let's face it, I mean, older folks, we start dying off, you know, and younger people, you kind of get older, and, you know, frankly, there's definitely a relationship between being older and voting. So you become a larger part of the electorate. And it's going to make it so that the white, straight, male, dominant culture that has been that has characterized the United States really since its founding is on its way out. And what we're seeing now is kind of the dying gasp of trying to hold on to that. And when you talk about trying to change their minds, they view Donald Trump as their savior, as the guy who's willing to stand up for them. And guess what? They're right. He is willing to stand up for them in that regard. The problem is that it's becoming a smaller and smaller sector of the population who agree with them. And that's what they're fighting over.
I mean, you know, I feel like I felt strongly about this. I don't know if it's the people believe in this perspective, but I feel like Obama being president, the first black president, made a lot of people mad. You know, they were mad that he became president. And because of that, that pent up kind of anger, they elected Trump. Because he represented the white male, the quintessential white redneck male. And I've talked about this on the podcast a lot, and it's kind of going on with your perspective about them seeing Trump as a savior. I feel like, honestly, if Jesus came down to earth and he ran for president as a Democrat, he'd get a lot of shit. Like, he'd get a lot of stuff. Yeah. So that's what I believe. But, you know, I just wanted to talk about an analogy that I was thinking about for a while in my head as you talk, but it was like with Trump leaving the WHO and not telling anybody, and even like firing Brad Parscale and not telling him, it's almost like you're divorcing your wife and not telling your kids.
Yeah.
You know? Or even not telling her. Like, it's, you can't do that. You have that kind of relationship. So he has to build that bond with his voters, with the American people, with his administration. And it's been broken too many times.
Yeah. Well, I think Varun too, you know, something else that you're pointing out, which is kind of an untold story about this, which it's going to take years for our country to recover the credibility it has as a result of this administration. I mean, think about Iran, okay? And Iran's a bad actor, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But yet they had a deal with us. And they, to give them credit, they actually have not really gone as far as they could have after the United States basically threw out that deal.
Yeah.
And I'm not just talking about Iran. Now, other countries are going to look at it and they're going to say, wait a minute, do I want to make a deal with the United States, knowing that they can go back on their deals so easily? I mean, this is going to allies of ours in Europe, they're going to say, wait a minute, can I really count on the United States to stand by us when they elect somebody like this and talks about withdrawing from NATO and things like that and from the WHO?
Yeah.
Our credibility as a nation is going to be permanently damaged, or at least for quite a while, as a result of this administration. And that has been something that up until really very recently has been something that Democrats and Republicans have been unified on, that politics ends at the water's edge, that we should be unified when we talk about foreign policy. And the fact that that he's politicized it in this way and kind of been so erratic in his dealings with foreign governments, it's made it so right now the United States is on the verge of becoming an international pariah. And this is something that's just very upsetting to me.
Yeah. Do you think Joe Biden can fix it? Do you think that he can kind of go back on what he's saying? Do you think that he's the right candidate for the job to kind of fix the whole, international situation? I mean, can he make us not a laughing stock, in your opinion?
Well, it's funny you say that, because I was not a Biden supporter in the primaries. I'll be honest with you. And I have had my concerns with Joe Biden, but I actually not too long ago on Medium wrote a column about how Joe Biden might actually be the right person for the times right now. And the reason I say that is there's this thing that he's sometimes called Uncle Joe, you know, and because he does kind of have this way about him, about being, he's very compassionate, he's very down to earth, he's very much of a regular person, and I think that that's kind of what we need right now. And the fact is, he's got a depth of experience in government and in foreign affairs that is virtually unequaled anywhere. So if there's anybody who's able to bring some stability and some credibility back to the United States government, he's the guy. Biggest concern I have, frankly, with him is the fact that we need some dramatic steps, I think, to address some of the crises that we're dealing with here. And I'll tell you, my biggest criticism of President Obama is that I feel that there are certain times when he really should have taken more dramatic steps than he was willing to take. And the classic case of that would have been during the financial crisis, when he took the position of, we're going to try to protect the banks. We're not going to try to hold them accountable. And I think that was a huge mistake. And frankly, in many respects, led to the frustration among men and disappointment among many people that led directly to Trump being elected. And so I think that's really important for for Biden to acknowledge the fact that he's going to have to take some dramatic steps to address the level of crisis that we're in now. I mean, we're to a Great Depression type of crisis now. We need the kind of leadership that FDR provided the United States at that time. And I just hope that Joe Biden's going to be able to do that.
I mean, we saw that, a couple of days ago, Joe Biden and Bernie released a joint agenda on climate change and the other crises like these. And I think that he's making moves towards being more progressive. And I think he's right now a very centrist person, almost like an old conservative, like what the conservative, the definition of that term was a couple of years ago. You know, Damien talks on the podcast a lot. I'm going to let him explain it, not me, later on. I think you know what I'm talking about conservatism today.
Basically, what I've always said is I've always considered myself a centrist because I've seen the Republican Party rather as the kind of the party of simple ideals. You know, facts are facts. We believe this because this is how it's written down. You know, they interpret the Constitution as the Constitution is written. There's nothing left up for interpretation. But now it's like, well, facts are facts when they come out of Donald Trump's mouth, and science isn't real if it doesn't support his agenda. So it's like, now I've considered myself, I can't do anything but say that I'm a Democrat right now, because being a Republican right now is being Donald Trump's puppet in a sense.
It's almost become like a cult now. Like a personality cult. And I'll tell you, it's really disturbing, because that's not the way it's supposed to be in the United States. You know, coming back to when Obama was president, you know, Democrats were critical of many of the things that he did. You know, again, I was very critical of his response to the banking crisis, where I felt that he was not handling things appropriately. You know, there are other things I think he did quite well as president. The fact that we could have that type of an honest dialogue is what makes American democracy work. And right now we have a party that's just not willing to engage in that kind of a conversation. And it really is causing a lot of harm to our democratic institutions.
Yeah, and I believe the same thing. I think that we need to have two kind of parties which believe in a certain rigid approach. I mean, I supported Mitt Romney, John McCain, especially as candidates. You know, I'm nostalgic of 2004, 2000, and 2008. Just those elections, because you know, we had such good candidates on either point of the spectrum. It was just a great political field, a playing field. But and I meant 2008, 2012. Sorry, I misphrased how I said that.
2004, we were learning to walk.
I was born in 2004, so not so much that year. But I guess I wanted to mention, I was thinking about while you were saying what you were saying, kind of the trajectory of our government. And you know, myself and Damien have been kind of more progressive than what we've seen from Biden, but also we're thinking about voters not just voting for a president, but also for two new Supreme Court justices, because have two justices who are in their old ages, especially RBG. Yeah. She's almost 80 years old. I think she's over that now. And she needs to retire. You know, she's only in office because she wants to live out her term until Trump is, you know, taken out from the presidency. I don't know how long she can go. She's a soldier for that. But we're also voting for a cabinet. You know, I think that a president is made by his cabinet. And I feel like Biden's going to select a really good cabinet. And I resonate with your point, you know, about Obama not being the best person for the job back then in some circumstances, especially. I mean, I didn't agree with his approach on the interrogation techniques used, waterboarding techniques used, because he was just like, I'm a postpartisan president. And that was his answer to everything. I'm postpartisan. But right now, it takes more than being postpartisan. It takes understanding what you stand up for and really standing up for that, because, I mean, you have to stand up for what you believe in. But, I mean, I wanted to ask you on a personal note, what are you most passionate about? What kind of policies do you think our country needs, especially in today's racial landscape, political landscape? What is your standpoints?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm committed to a lot of different issue areas, but probably the ones that I'm most passionate about come down to economic issues, in particular economic justice, I think, at this point. I'm really bothered by the fact that we have such incredible inequality in our country now. You know, yeah. The United States is supposed to be the nation of opportunity. You know, this was the place that people came to from overseas because they didn't have opportunities there, and they wanted to come here to, you know, find the country where the streets were paved with gold. Well, I mean, the streets weren't quite paved with gold, but at least there was this attitude that your kids would always do better than you. That's not really the case anymore, except for a very small segment of the American population. Mm-hmm. It used to be that we were the home of the middle class. And again, not really the case anymore. And this is something that has had absolutely dramatic impact, you know, for people who are in the white working class as well as in the black working class, and Hispanics as well. You know, it doesn't really matter what your racial background is. So I am probably what I want to see more than anything at this point is some type of effort to try to turn around the kind of the economic barriers that have been set up to really most people in the country being able to make it to the higher levels. You know, we say that, you know, especially Republicans, they say, you know, hey, we want to provide opportunities, everybody has the same opportunity, but it's becoming increasingly clear that the way that our economic system is set up now, opportunities are not spread evenly to everybody, and that's really something I think that needs to be reversed if our country is going to be able to survive in the long term.
Yeah, I mean, on the podcast, we talk about all the time how important financial literacy is, and unfortunately, yeah. That's something that not everyone, you know, two interesting points, I suppose, is the fact that, you know, in a lot of sense, the white privilege is the fact that you're poor, and obviously this applies to white people, you know. Financial illiteracy can also most definitely apply to people of all races. It doesn't discriminate. And that's something that needs to be understood very well. And I say it especially when we're talking about coal miners who are now losing their jobs when they're being promised that they're going to get their jobs back. This is going to be the next, you know, population of people who are angry with our country and who can't resonate why they were left behind. And we can't leave them behind. We have to go in and teach them how to, you know, about stocks and bonds and about the new modern age of technology. And that goes beyond the point, but what I was saying is, you know, the unfortunate thing is the fact that African Americans oftentimes are poor because they never had financial literacy to start with. Whereas most in situations where Caucasians are poor, it's because of the fact that they failed on their financial literacy. In the sense that they didn't use it appropriately. But beyond that point, something that I kind of wanted to go back to, and a very interesting thing, and I don't know why this started just racing in my mind, but as I was watching Hamilton, a very strange jump that I'm making here, but as I was watching Hamilton, it'll make sense in a second. As I was watching Hamilton, there was a line that was talking about how the South's debt was paid and that they didn't have any paid or any debt or anything. And I think Hamilton responded saying that they didn't have any debt because of the fact that, you know, they had slave labor and they weren't paying for their labor. They didn't have anything. And it's very interesting now how that is still true. And what I mean by that is we're outsourcing to countries that are paying people nothing. And that's how we're getting – that's how we're making these people extremely rich. You know, Amazon isn't – it doesn't have – you know, they're not paying $9 for labor. They're getting slave labor in a sense.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't even know if you need to go that far away to find that they're getting slave labor, because you're right. I mean, they are. But let's face it, you know, most Americans right now are working for wages that really aren't enough to support a family. The fact that we have a situation where during this virus that's going on right now, people are literally faced with the choice of either going back to work in an environment where they don't feel safe, or literally being poverty stricken in a country where, frankly, the safety net we have is pretty thin. What options are there? I mean, that to me is that really so different from slave labor at a certain point here? You know, it reminds me of back when the Civil War was over, you know, and in as you mentioned, in the South, there was this change between, you know, oh, we're not going to have slaves anymore, but oh, yes, we're going to have sharecropping. And is it really that different from slavery?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, right now is the situation that many people find themselves in. Is it really that different from sharecropping? You know, do they really have any kind of control over their own economic destiny? And until that happens, I mean, I'm afraid to say that we're not going to have the kind of broad-based prosperity that really is what I think most people want.
Yeah. And I can name out instances, like I can name out how we have literally on a former slave plantation in one of the states in the U.S., we're having, you know, people, prisoners being used as labor for the private prison system. That's slavery in a sense. And we have slavery, not slavery especially, but, you know, ICE camps, determined camps, like almost like internship camps of the Chinese so long ago. So, I mean, the world is a lot of the same thing that has been going on for a long time, because the same kinds of people are in control, you know, that kind of white male majority. I think that as diversity grows, you know, we interviewed on our podcast for all of our listeners, our viewers, you know, we had Brenda Lopez Romero, the first Latina congresswoman in the Georgia legislature, on Sam Park, the first Asian American and the first openly gay congressman on the podcast. His episode's getting released today on Friday, I believe. But, you know, we've had people like this in politics, and it increases the amount of diversity we have and the amount of new ideas we have. I think that once we have young people, as you said, people with more diverse ideas, we're going to have a more progressive political landscape, because right now it's the same old procedure. I think that we have to move forward and definitely get things done with the young population.
Yes, I totally agree with that. You know, the truth of the matter is, to me, one of the great tricks that has occurred in our society has been the success that kind of the white male patriarchal establishment has had in convincing the kind of the white working class to throw their support to the powerful, as opposed to realizing that they have common cause with other people who might look different from them, but who really are in the same economic situation that they're in. You know, think how much better the working class of all races would be right now if they realized, hey, you know, maybe we could all benefit from a higher minimum wage or from better, you know, better working conditions.
Yeah.
As opposed to saying, oh, you know, you mentioned the people who are the coal miners, you know, rather than saying, you know, hey, you know, we want to keep things the way they are, and so we're going to support this. We're going to support this backward-looking administration that makes us feel good about the way things are, as opposed to realizing that things are changing and we better get on board and kind of find some way to be a part of the change rather than to be fighting against it.
And something that I find extremely interesting is when you have people that are suffering and that are suffering, I mean, in the sense that they're not making a sufficient income to be comfortable, defending these large corporations and being like, oh, a $15 minimum wage will completely destroy our economy. It's like, well, what's it doing for you right now? It's just, it's an interesting take where you have these people dying on this hill because, frankly, you know, again, I always love to take a bipartisan approach, but Republicans are telling them, you know, we have to protect our, they're saying, you know, we have to protect our backbone, but they're saying that the backbone now is these large industries. So it's very interesting that you have these people that are suffering and that could really benefit from a $15 minimum wage and other economic policies that are almost choosing to literally die on this hill, that they've been kind of in a sense brainwashed to believe, you know, we can't.
Oh, definitely
we can't.
Definitely they have been. And I'll tell you, there are a couple of things that I think from an economic perspective that people generally should be really concerned about. Like, for example, part of what has made the American economy so resilient is the fact that we have this great ability to create new businesses, you know, this entrepreneurial spirit that we talk about, and that people go out and they want to take a risk and they want to start a small business, they want to chase their dreams. That's what has created all the great opportunities that has made America, you know, what it is. And what the data has shown, though, is since the economic crisis back in 2008, though, the percentage of our economy that is being made up of by new small business has actually been declining. And so as a result, we don't have kind of the vitality in our economy that we once did. I would also like to point out too, the level of consolidation that you have among these large corporations. This has been unprecedented. It's only getting more and more consolidated to the point where basically we're living in a society where most industries are oligopolies now.
Yeah.
And there isn't really the opportunity for some new idea to emerge, you know? I mean, do you really think right now in the computer industry that another Microsoft could come about or another Google could come about?
Yeah.
Because you've got these huge companies that are there that have so consolidated their power that they're going to make sure that if they can essentially outcompete that company, that they'll buy them out. And it just leaves a situation where there isn't that level of innovation and entrepreneurship and essentially dynamism that has made the American economy so strong over so long. And that really is something that concerns me, I got to tell you.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's talking about it being a repeat of history. I mean, we had trusts taking up, you know, the majority of American sales during the industrial age, you know,
right.
And that's kind of a repeat of history. We're having these big consolidations, corporations, conglomerates becoming what America is and how we don't have that kind of diversity in the economic industries that we have right now. And more than even, you know, you're talking about how white people and black people or people who are fighting for the same thing can't understand their mutual cause. It's sometimes even Democrats and Republicans. And in a lot of circumstances, it is, you know, a lot of the things that they're fighting for are the same. Right. And honestly, I was going to repeat this back. I mean, bring it back to history again. I mean, in the middle of history, Democratic Party took the Republicans' ideals or the other way around, I forget. But one of the other parties was just like, I'm going to switch my entire playing field because this party took my ideals. So they switched up exactly what they were doing because the party took their ideals. And I think that's what could happen now because we're so politically aligned. I mean, Damien talked about it a long time ago. I keep referring to what Damien said because I love his insights. But he talked about the fact that, you know, at a date, some people might introduce themselves as Democrats or Republicans and not as like, you know, regular people worried about their country. And right now in politics, we have people introducing themselves and making themselves known as Democrats or Republicans. Yeah. But really it should be, I'm an American citizen. I'm a U.S. Senator. I work for the country and not for the Democratic Party. And that's what we're having right now.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think it comes back to, I forget which one of you talked about this, but the fact that that there's this unwillingness to kind of engage in a debate about the issues, and really, you know, people, you know, they harden their position to the point where they're unwilling to listen to anything except what they believe. And it's gotten to the point now where we've made it our identity, you know, what our politics is.
Yep.
And as a result, we're kind of unwilling to back away from what it is, you know, because of the fact that, you know, our identity is as a Republican or as a Democrat. If somebody's going to challenge that, then it's not just, oh, they disagree with me. It's a direct threat to how I view myself.
So
people become very defensive about their views. And it's really made it to the point now where it's very difficult to have honest discussions with people about you know, policy or politics in general.
Yeah, no, and something interesting about that, you know, I, as Varun was saying, I always say it's horrible, you know, in a sense, it almost seems like you could have two people going on a date and one person says, tell me about yourself. And the first thing they say is I'm Republican or Democrat.
Yeah.
And an interesting point, I love reading and I've gotten really into reading recently. So I read Ghost at a Watchman, which is the sequel to Kill a Mockingbird. And one of the very interesting points is it's a quote, you know, I'm paraphrasing here. I'm probably the worst at remembering quotes directly, but it's something along the lines of your friends need you most when they disagree with you. And it's very interesting because now it feels like, you know, oh, I can't be friends with the other. I can't be friends with a Republican. I can't be friends with a Democrat if I'm Democrat. I can't be friends with a Republican the other way around. It's just such an interesting take on modern politics where we get so defensive about our positions that we're not willing to listen. And oftentimes we're arguing about the same things with different names. It's just gotten to the point where we're just arguing in circles. But speaking of kind of arguing about different things, a very interesting take is that I always, you know, the Trump campaign has always first of all, they made racist remarks, extremely racist remarks, and then said that they're not racist. But beyond anything, they've said that, you know, they can't stand by what their supporters say, right? They've always said that. You know, if our supporters are racist, we can't decide that. But something interesting is that the new ad that they're running on Joe Biden is Joe Biden's supporters want to defund the police. So now they're putting Joe Biden's policies in the like they're saying what Joe Biden's supporters want are his policies, which is it's so hypocritical.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I mean, if you're looking for consistency, unfortunately, you're not going to find a lot of that. Administration.
Yeah.
And again, that really is what distinguishes, though, again, the people who I view as being Republicans with integrity, who there are Republicans with integrity, don't get me wrong, or conservatives with integrity, you know, you know, who, again, I may disagree with on a lot of issues, but at least they support truth, you know, saying things that are true.
Yeah.
They try to be consistent in their positions, and they, you know, and they put view themselves as Americans first. You know, people like that, you know, I can deal with all day long. The problem is that the politics has kind of become weaponized so much under this administration that people kind of have to pick a side. And oftentimes when they pick Trump's side, they find themselves in a position that they're just not able to, you know, say anything except kind of the party line.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm going to say one last thing because I think I'm loving this interview a lot. But it's been almost an hour, and I didn't realize it was almost an hour. I thought it was like 30 minutes or so. But it's been quite a while for us. I just wanted to end individually on the point that, like, you know, politics today has been so identified or identity politics has been so pervasive in today's world that we're forgetting, you know, who we are inside. And I think of it as truth Democrats and truth Republicans. You know, we have people on both ends of the spectrum who believe in what they're saying and they have a moral responsibility to the American people. But we have people, even as Democrats, who are bought and sold for, bought and paid for, sorry, by these partisan interests, you know, these lobbyists, these corporate funds. And I think that I work for a congressional campaign, which is still going, Solomon Rajput in Michigan, your state. And, you know, his campaign's completely progressive. I worked as a fellow for his campaign. But the person he was running against, a Democrat, I think it's Debbie Dingell or Dingell.
Yep.
And she's, I believe she's bought and paid for by corporate interest. And she's been in the dynasty, political dynasty for a long time. And I think that it goes to show that there's truth Democrats and truth Republicans. We have to stop becoming sponsored by corporations and become, you know, politicians in our own regard and by our own morals.
Yeah. I think you're right. And I think fundamentally, the biggest issue that needs to be addressed is this idea that there are simple solutions to these things. Because, you know, we're dealing with a huge country that's very diverse, that has many different people involved in many different with many different kinds of enterprises, and all their interests need to be balanced in a way that we can all kind of get along together and live together. And that's the challenge of having a civil society and having a successful government. There is no such thing as easy solutions. And when government is done properly, a lot of the time it's not cool and sexy the way that it gets portrayed sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an old saying that there are two things that you never want to see being made. One is sausages and the other is legislation. And the reason that saying is true is because legislation, when it's done right, involves this difficult process of weighing all these different interests and trying to come up with something that's going to work in this kind of a diverse country. And you know, I don't want to, you know, because I agree with basically what you were saying just now. I think that was Varun who was saying that. But by the same token, you know, we also need to acknowledge the fact that within this country, corporate interests do have value. I mean, let's face it, they create a lot of jobs in this country. They create a lot of wealth in this country. I'm not saying that they're all the bad guys all the time, you know, but yet they can't operate in a way, though, that their interests run over everybody else's interests. And that's where we start to get into a problem.
Yeah, definitely. And as we're nearing the end of this amazing interview, first and foremost, I want to thank you for coming on. And I want to ask you our staple question, the question we ask to every single one of our guests, and that is, if you had one quote, one saying, one message that you could leave to America's youth, what would it be?
Oh, I know exactly what it is. And it's an old saying by Edmund Burke, and it goes like this. The way for evil to succeed is for all good men to do nothing. So forgive the fact that it's a sexist at this point. It's an old quote.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, and with that quote, we come to the end of our segment with you today. And once again, I want to thank you for coming on. I think you have an extremely insightful view on all these different issues, and it was an amazing interview. And to our guests, I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and we hope to see you guys on our next segment, which will be this Wednesday. Thank you.
Yeah, I had fun. I feel like hopefully you guys had fun on the podcast today, and I'll end on saying that silence is complicity, as you said, you know. The only way for evil to succeed is if all good men do nothing. Silence is complicity. Make your opinions heard and voice your opinions, whether it's being Republican or Democrat. Voice what you believe in. And that's what I'm going to end on. And make sure to go on our website at www.politateenpodcast.com to wait for this interview to upload, and follow us on Twitter at Politateen Show. Thank you all so much, and have a great day. Hello everyone, thank you so much for watching today's episode of the Politateen Podcast. As always, we appreciate and thank you for your support over these past couple of weeks as we've grown as a podcast and as a duo between myself and Damien. And please follow us on Twitter at Politateen Show, and always, as always, make sure to follow us on Instagram at Politateen Show, and to connect with us via email at politateenpodcast@gmail.com. Make sure to check out our newly hosted website at politateenpodcast.com. And lastly, please consider becoming a sponsor, a donor for our campaign on Patreon. You can get a link to that through our website at www.politateenpodcast.com. And through becoming a sponsor, you can get some amazing exclusive perks, such as a way to contact us for questions, suggestions, becoming part of an exclusive community where you can kind of talk about your political viewpoints and ask questions of our guests as they come on. You know, live streams of us talking, and even posters, stickers to rep Politateen. So as always, have a great rest of your day, and thank you so much for your support over these past couple of weeks. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Thank you so much.